Good afternoon, and welcome to our roundtable. Prescription drugs, cost, access, and affordability. My name is Lisa Holland, and I'm the Senior Manager of Communication. I'll be your host and moderator for today's event. Before we get started, I just wanted to give a background on why we're hosting this event today. As you may know, scores of families across the nation routinely make hard choices between paying for their life-saving medications and necessities such as food, gas, and utilities. Following a tumultuous year of historic proportions, high and rising prescription drug costs remain a serious issue. We have, here at Families USA, a very special media fellowship with West Health, where we have dived into these issues of high prescription drug costs. And you can find more about that on our website, actinhighdrugprices.org. During today's panel, we will hear from one of our media fellows that was a part of that West Health Media Fellowship as far as consumers, reporters, and Families USA staff, where we'll discuss access and affordability challenges and how issues such as COVID-19, equity, and the economic downturn are affecting drug costs. Following each of our two panels, we'll have a question and answer session, and our wonderful operator, Orlando, will provide instructions on asking questions. And so now we'll get started with our first panel, and that's going to be on voter experience. And we'll hear from Sandra Wilkmith, who's Director of Complex Care Policy and a senior fellow here at Families USA, and two of our storytellers, Antoinette Worsham from Cincinnati, Ohio, and Maureen Allen from Talking Rock, Georgia. And we'll start with Sandra. Sandra, talk to us a little bit about the heart research dial testing findings. And then after that, if you could talk about the Western messaging. So this is all, if I'm understanding this correctly, this is sort of trying to understand how people are responding to stories and how to talk about certain issues with regards to health policy and specifically prescription drugs. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The heart messaging really went to the heart of that. Sorry, no pun intended. that particular issue on prescription drugs and the Western messaging, which we're really enthusiastic to be in partnership with as well. You know, it's just a bit of a broader landscape around health and health issues of healthcare in the country. So I'll definitely take a little bit of a deeper dive into the heart messaging findings. And before that, I just did want to say a couple of things really quickly. First of all, really appreciate the opportunity to partner with the media fellows. It was just an extraordinary experience, and I'm really grateful that this audience has a chance to hear from one of them. And I also just want to take a couple of minutes, if you don't mind, to provide us, you know, a bit of the broader context before we hear from, you know, these powerful stories from two women who directly confronted the impossible trade-offs that you alluded to, Lisa. You know, just a few high-level, you know, pieces of information I think is important to remind us. Unaffordable medicines are a persistent and unrelenting challenge to the health and well-being of America's families. And even before the pandemic, the burden was so prevalent that family hardship due to unaffordable medicines was deemed financially toxic. That's a pretty powerful term and pretty meaningful. And the burden continues. So even in the midst of the crisis, manufacturers are increasing prices on hundreds of drugs last year and at least 800 drugs so far this year, and we're only in January. So that's something to continue to pay attention to. And this is increases beyond the rate of inflation for those of you paying attention to, you know, how big the increases are. And the situation is only exacerbated by the dual crises of the COVID-19 pandemic and the economic fallout that too many of our American families are facing, making those really difficult trade-offs to pay for life-sustaining medicines or to ration life-sustaining medicines in many cases. And I just wanted to note that the impact is substantial and it's quantifiable. So, for example, a recent West Health study found that well over 1 million Medicare patients could die over the next decade because they cannot afford to pay for their prescription medicines. That's if our policies continue as they are. The same study found that if Medicare is authorized to negotiate better prices, about 100,000 of those people's lives would be spared and would result in close to $500 billion in savings that could be reinvested in achieving better health. Really notable findings. And with that backdrop, let me get back to your question, Lisa, which is really about what have we learned from the HARC research findings. And
if you could, before you started that, could you please repeat, because those were some really important stats you just laid out. Could you please repeat those? I think you said about the Medicaid patients could die, and then the other stat you gave. I want to make sure that we just let that sit with everyone before you get started. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for underscoring that. So important. So a couple of numbers I threw out. The first was around the number of drugs in which we saw price increases. This is over the past year during the pandemic. Hundreds of drugs last year, and I am happy to share additional information with anybody on follow-up. But so far this year, over 800 drugs, prices have been increased. Most of those are brand name drugs. A few are generic drugs. And this is just so far in January, over 800 drugs. Price increases on average about a little over 4% price increase, which is above the rate of inflation. So I noted those findings. And then I also wanted to highlight a recent study by West Health. It was from November of last year, in which they found that well over a million Medicare patients, so Medicare in this case, could die over the next year because they cannot afford to pay for their prescription drugs. And that's if policy stays the way they are. And if they don't, if we authorize Medicare to negotiate better prices, about 100,000 of those lives, I think it was 94,000 to be exact, would be spared and would result in close to $500 billion in savings that could be reinvested in achieving better health. So those are the findings. Happy to answer more questions on follow-ups or provide those references for people to dig in deeper. But with that backdrop, Lisa, go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say yes. I think that West Health study, because our media fellows did dive in and their articles that they were producing last year did cite it, and it had some very, very interesting information. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, exactly. You bet. Exactly right. So that's one place to really dive in deeper and understand the context a little further as well.
Right.
With that backdrop, we partnered with Jeff Guerin of HARC Research and West Health, and collectively decided we really needed to get an understanding of on the ground how are people really experiencing the situation of high-cost prescription drugs, and what do they want, the U.S. to do about it. So some key takeaways from that work, and then I want to make sure to leave plenty of time for other panelists. So I'll just hit the highlights, happy to follow up on Q&A. First finding is reducing the cost of prescription, and this was a polling of a representative sample of voters. It was conducted this summer. And a few key takeaways. One is reducing the cost of prescription drugs and putting a stop to excessive drug pricing is a powerful issue across the aisle. And there's more recent polling to confirm this, which, again, I'm happy to follow up with folks. Two, voters put a high priority on congressional action to address high drug prices, and there's overwhelming support for legislation to give Medicare the power to negotiate with drug companies for lower prices. And then three, large majorities of voters believe that drug companies charge unreasonably high amounts of medicine, and this is sort of in the context of mixed views about the drug companies, and that most Americans face difficulties in affording the cost of prescriptions. And what's interesting is this is even true if respondents themselves weren't managing high-cost drugs, but they are very concerned about their fellow Americans who may be in that situation. A couple other things to note. People feel the COVID-19 pandemic has only increased the importance of high prescription drug costs. This is especially true among young voters, and Black and Latinx people really stood out in this particular finding. There is overwhelming support across party lines for legislation that would cap the price of any COVID-19 vaccines or treatments developed with federal funding, another really important finding that people are aware that they, too, are taking on risk to invest in vaccines and treatments and that we should act accordingly in the U.S. And then I finally just wanted to note, you referred to the personal stories, and there was a whole section of this work that really I took a look at people's experiences with others, personal stories about managing high-priced drugs. It really powerfully resonated across the aisle again. And really interestingly, those stories evoked an urgent need for congressional action and were much more powerful than industry messages about potential threats to innovation that may be cause if action is taken. So that's civilian, let me just repeat that. So people's personal stories are around struggling with the high price of drugs and affordability. Evoked a more powerful response than concerns about threats to innovation should we take action to reduce prices. So those are the findings. With that, I'm happy to turn it back to you, Lisa, and I'm happy to be available during Q&A.
Great. Thank you very much, Sandra. And because of you left us with this idea of personal stories are powerful and invoke an urgent need for congressional action, perfect time to tee up where we hear from our storytellers directly. So first, we're going to hear from Antoinette Worsham. Again, she's from Cincinnati, Ohio. Antoinette, welcome. I understand that you've been interviewed by one of our media fellows that could not join us, Hazel Trice Edney, for a recent story. So if you could just talk about that and then your experience and just sort of what has this meant for you? I know in talking to you, it's an access issue, and you unfortunately had that you'll get into the death of one of your daughters. And so you could just talk a little bit about your experience and then kind of what you feel like, you know, what needs to be done to end this problem.
Well, my name is Antoinette Worsham. I'm the mother of two type 1 diabetics. My oldest daughter, she was diagnosed when she was 16 and only lived 6 years with the disease due to the high cost of insulin. So my problem is not the access, it's affordability. And so I think that's a little different than access. And so I have spoken, with so many news outlets on my tragic loss. I've spoken in front of Congress, and I've even traveled over to Canada where insulin is 10 times cheaper. My youngest daughter, she's 20. She'll be 21. I actually have the letter laying here on the table now letting me know that, hey, her coverage is about to expire soon. She's on CMH here in Ohio. It's a government-funded program that pays for all of her diabetes management, treatment, insulin, supplies, things of that nature, whatever she needs to keep her alive. And on June the 9th, she'll actually be, she'll age off of that. So no more coverage. So I'm just like I don't know what we're going to do as far as the supplies at this point. Because of my employer right now, her insulin there's a $0 cost to me out of pocket. Of course, there's a cost to my employer. But I'm devastated at when she turns 26 or when I leave that job, you know, what's going to happen. So I'm going to continue to fight for affordable insulin in America because we know it could be done. We know Congress can make it happen. President Trump, former President Trump, you know, did keep this on his radar. And so I am holding, the Biden administration accountable to make sure that it's still, you know, in the works and that it's going to be affordable to the American people. Now with Antavia, as soon as she aged off, that's when we started having problems with affording her insulin, and she passed away at the age of 22 years old. I talk about this. I get emotional about it. I miss my baby so much. But we have to do something because I do have another daughter who's impacted, in the next upcoming years. Or, again, if I was to leave my current employer and, you know, go somewhere else anything should happen, right? You know, I have to worry about her because she's in college right now. She's in undergrad studying law, and she has one more year, and we pray that when she graduates, you know, she'll get a job where, or land a career where her insurance is phenomenal, where she doesn't have to worry about this. Some people blame it on the insurance companies, but I try to educate people because I work in the revenue cycle, and I know about insurance and providers and things of that nature, and I'm a business owner. And so I know it's not just the insurance company. It's how much that employer wants to pay. It's what formulary they want to pay for. And so, two, if we get more employers, that will, you know, expand the benefits of insurance, I think that, too, will help. But it definitely starts, you know, from our Congress, from our attorney generals, and, you know, each state, right, to look at these prices that these companies, pharmaceutical companies, are charging the American people. You have the rebates, and as you all know, again, former President Trump had for the Medicare recipients that law that he put into cap, and now the Biden administration, they've frozen that. And so they're not going to look at it until March. Well, you know, it's the beginning of the year. You have people that, you know, have to meet their deductible or the donut hole for Medicare recipients, and people are dying, you know, just like COVID. And it's like, okay, they were so swift at getting a cure or, excuse me, not a cure, but a vaccination for the COVID, but you still have people that are out here that they can't afford their life-sustaining medication. But now COVID, the vaccine is free. I mean, so we need more people in leadership that's really going to listen to the American people and what's really going on out here. And we need more people like myself and others that are speaking up about the issue to speak up about it and not be silent. Just a year ago, on January 20th of last year, I spoke in front of the Capitol on corruption, government corruption. That's a documentary that's going to come out in some time. But, you know, I talked about it, and I said, we can't be silent. We have to, you know, let the people know that the American people were hurting out here. And it's not just, you know, what I don't like is that they always talk about the black community. Diabetes is not just in the black community. People needing insulin is not just in the black community. It's all communities. So when I speak, I don't like to speak about the black community. I like to speak about the American people, because the American people is not one color. It's not one race. Everybody is hurting that can't afford their life-sustaining health care.
Yes.
So
yes.
That's who I am.
I agree. Yes, I agree with that assessment, Antoinette. And I feel, I again, thank you for sharing your perspective.
We
appreciate that. We just want to sort of reiterate that we want to be able to have affordability and access so that people
right.
are not, as you
Absolutely.
Said, they're not dying because they can't afford their medication. So we want
right.
that to be sort of across the board. We want all of our members of Congress to work on that and to be able to achieve those goals. Thank you. Maureen, I want to move on to you. You are taking Eliquis. It's very expensive. You noted when we talked that that's kind of ruining your retirement. Can you talk a little bit about that and just, you know, we talked about how you've had to adjust some things and sort of, you know, how the retirement is kind of derailed because of these costs. So if you could talk a little bit about that. Really appreciate hearing your perspective.
Sure. But I have to start by saying how grateful I am to Families First, because this is exactly what Antoinette was saying. We feel actually heard, listened to, and I sense that this program is going much higher and taking our stories much higher, and I'm beyond grateful for that. Having said that, since you can't see me, I'll just tell you I'm 80 years old. I'm totally dependent on Social Security. I live in solitary splendor in a little house on 6 acres in the North Georgia mountains. And I'm extremely healthy. except for this little matter of a couple of blood clots in my leg, in my left leg, and in my lungs. So I was prescribed Eliquis when I came out of the hospital, and I learned that I was going to be on Eliquis forever and ever. I feel like I'm whining because there are so many people who don't even have access to this medication, and I think Sandra hit on that a little while ago, and I can't tell you how stunning the messages were, how powerful. Eliquis has no competitors at all, so they are free to charge almost $600 for a 3-month refill, which to a person on Social Security is a pretty heavy lift. And that's the price with insurance. Heaven only knows what it is if you don't have insurance. My insurance company only allows 3-month refills, unless you care to call in every single month and remind them. So I transferred my script to the local grocery store, and the price doesn't change, but at least it's more manageable at $144 every month, which is still a heavy lift. It's just divided up differently. So if you're wondering, I did appeal to Eliquis for help and was turned away. But still, yeah, I feel blessed to get it at all, because I probably wouldn't be here talking to you if I couldn't. I would say that, well, I'm not the spokesmodel for capitalism, but I honestly believe that if there were more competition, this price would come down. I wanted to talk about the financial impact, and I know you already get the picture, but it seems to me that in retirement, one of the last things one should have to obsess about is money for medication. And in contemplating that, I decided that rather than obsess, I will just give up things, but not the things that I waited a lifetime to do. Number one of which is playing with horses. And so I'm not giving that up. And I'm not giving up adopting another dog from a kill shelter. No, indeed. What I'm giving up is food. I'm down to one meal a day, which is fine, and a whole lot more than millions and millions of people worldwide are able to get. And I eat healthfully, and that's fine. I'm glad to do it. I also drink a ton of water because it fills you up. I'm also giving up the dentist, in which I imagine many people would like to join me. It's not our favorite thing. That's kind of a first world option, but I'm glad to do it. I also drive as little as possible to keep auto costs down. That's how I handle it financially, with minimal impact on my lifestyle, which I intend to continue. As far as COVID is concerned, I live a solitary life anyway, and I drive minimally anyway. But like a great many people, I'm anxious about getting vaccinated, and more anxiety is not a good thing. Anxious about Eliquis, anxious about vaccine, anxious about being exposed. It's just too much. So I stay quarantined, and at this particular moment in time, I feel very grateful to y'all for holding this program, and I feel like I've learned 10 times as much as I've offered, and that's all I have.
We appreciate that. Thank you very much. And you said you feel anxiety about being vaccinated, being exposed, you know, because you do have the pre-existing condition, and then also, you know, being able to continue affording your medication. And
that you said if there were more competition, the price would come down. That's correct?
That's absolutely right. Boy, you got it. Yeah. You nailed it.
Yeah. Okay, well, those are really good points. Thank you for sharing your story with us. We're going to open it up for a really quick question and answer session, and we're going to have our operator, Orlando, go over the instructions for asking questions.
Thank you. And if you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, everyone, please press star 1 if you would like to ask a question at this time. We'll pause for just a moment. As an additional reminder, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad if you would like to ask a question. And it appears currently we have no questions in the queue.
Okay. If we don't have any questions, we're going to move on to our second panel, but I will add that you can follow up. If you don't want to ask the question now and you want to ask it later, you can just send me an email and I can get that to one of our speakers. It's L Holland, L-H-O-L-L-A-N-D, at familiesusa.org. And so now we're going to move to our second panel, and this is going to be Insights from the Hill and Media. And I do also want to thank our other speakers from panel 1, Sandra Wilkness, and our storytellers, Antoinette Worsham and Maureen Allen. I really think it's important to hear from folks what they're experiencing and just hear their side of the story. You never know what someone's going through unless you talk with them. And as Sandra talked about the dial testing, it's just important to hear about these stories. The personal stories resonate, and they get Congress to act. So we're going to hear more about getting Congress to act and what might be on the pipeline for prescription drugs coming up in 2021. We're going to hear from Harris Meyer. He is a freelance writer and one of our West Health Media Fellows. Alex Ruoff, he covers healthcare for Bloomberg Government. And Jen Taylor, she's our Senior Director of Federal Relations here at Families USA. So first we're going to get started with Harris. And Harris, you're on the line, correct?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Okay, great. Yes, I can hear you. Wonderful. So if you could just get started. So I want you to kind of speak from the perspective of one of our media fellows covering this issue, because I don't know if you got a chance to listen to Maureen tell her story, but you interviewed her as well as some other seniors. So were the stories similar? Can you talk a little bit about what they were facing?
Yes. I have learned a great deal. I've been covering healthcare for a long time, but I really was not aware to this extent before talking to folks in these situations how dire really the drug cost problem is. It gets elevated to this sort of very dry policy debate, but the impact on people's lives is really dramatic, as Maureen mentioned. But I'm not, you know, I just wanted to start with a quote from Daniel Klein, who's the CEO of the PAN Foundation, which provides drug pay co-assistance to more than 100,000 people a year. He said, "If you are a normal consumer, you don't know much about any of this until you get sick, and all of a sudden you find out you can't afford your medication." And that was the experience for, a lot of the people I talked to. Who, you know, were, middle-class working people, and then they retired and went on Medicare, or they didn't retire, but they went on Medicare, and all of a sudden they faced these enormous out-of-pocket costs. And the Medicare Part D program, it was thought that the donut hole was closed. That was a big accomplishment of the Affordable Care Act. And some of my editors actually said, well, I thought the donut hole was closed and people didn't have to pay. Well, theoretically it is, but the list price, the very high list price of many of these drugs, which, as you may know, can run $100,000, $200,000 a year as the list price, people pay on Medicare Part D, which is the Medicare drug plan, they pay 5% once they reach the catastrophic phase. It's about $6,500 a year in drug spending. They have to pay 5% out of pocket of the list price, meaning 5% of the $200,000 a year, with no limit. So I talked to a number of people
Can you repeat that again? I want that to sit with folks. 5% out of pocket.
5% of the list price of the drug they pay out of pocket. Okay. So I interviewed people, for instance, Marilyn Rose in New Jersey, who is, I'm just looking at my notes here, who's paying about $10,000 a year for her cancer drug, which is Sprycel, which costs about $200,000 a year. And she was on private insurance, and then she just recently went on Medicare, and she was shocked that she was going to have to be paying $10,000 a year, at least, for her Sprycel, or else she'd have to switch to another drug, which might not be as effective. Now, Alex will probably talk about this, but there are proposals in Congress to cap the out-of-pocket cost. The Democratic proposal is $2,000 a year. The bipartisan proposal in the Senate was $3,100 a year, but that's part of a much bigger drug bill, which Alex will probably talk about, and the prospects of that are very uncertain in the near future. Now, the way some people deal with this is another problem. A big problem is when people go from private insurance working to Medicare. And one, beside the difference, people in private insurance, many private plans cover drugs pretty well, and people have modest out-of-pocket costs. And in private insurance, they can appeal, they can ask the drug company, which Maureen alluded to, for assistance with their copay, and the drug company will pick up the copay. Their insurer, the person's insurer, will pick up the bulk of the cost, and the drug manufacturer will pick up the copay. The problem is when you go to Medicare rules, for good reasons actually, do not allow Medicare patients to receive assistance directly from their drug manufacturer, because that would, the thinking is that would drive up drug spending. So this gets complicated. It sort of boggled my mind going through this, but then people on Medicare have to apply for funding, copay assistance from independent foundations like I mentioned the PAN Foundation, which are not tied to one particular drug or manufacturer. But the problem there is funding is very limited. These foundations are swamped with applications, and so you have to call repeatedly to get the little window where they have money, and then they run out. And if you miss that window, you're out of luck. It's an incredibly grotesque system. One of the quotes I got from the Federal Affairs Director for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Foundation is, "That's not the way to run a healthcare system, with people having to be either lucky or capable enough to access this private sector funding." And not to go on and on, but I will say a lot of people don't know about this private sector funding. Even quite sophisticated people. I just interviewed a patient in Seattle who was a consultant with Price Waterhouse, a sophisticated woman. She is at the point, she actually had to sell her house to fund her arthritis drug. She's on Medicare. And she didn't know about this patient assistance. I told her about it. I gave her the email. You may not appreciate this, but Daniel Klein's email, the CEO of the PAN Foundation, and said, "You should contact the PAN Foundation and other patient assistance groups," which this very sophisticated woman didn't know about, and her doctors apparently hadn't told her about. So this is dire stuff. And I'm going to stop there and let you pass it on to Alex or whatever you want to do.
Yes, thanks, Harris. Appreciate that. I do want to pass it on because I'm interested in hearing just because we're hearing like the consumers, you know, what they're going through. And then I just want to hear from Alex, who's, you know, covering Congress and covering policies, and Jim, who's working on these issues. I want to hear from them. Want them to kind of react to what you said, and how is that going to impact, you know, constituents needing to, you know, they can't afford their medication, they're having to resort to getting to fundraising to be able to afford things. So what does this look like for the landscape of legislation into 2021? And so I'm going to first hear, we're going to hear from Alex, and then we'll hear from Jim Taylor. And thanks again, Harris.
Yeah, thanks for that introduction. Yes, so this is Alex Roff with Bloomberg Government. I think Harris is right that there are a lot of healthcare costs come at people in different ways. You know, there are seniors who, through Medicare, you know, hit different structures of costs and different kinds of out-of-pocket costs. And there's definitely, you know, issues for people who take specialty drugs, which are very expensive, and often you have to go through very Byzantine insurance rules to get, and then, you know, can be costly. These are different problems that have different solutions. And, you know, lawmakers in Congress have thought of very different ways to go about this. You know, the House last Congress passed a very large bill that looked to get a whole, sort of get around all, or at least a huge chunk of drug cost issues, HR3, you know, which became a big part of their healthcare platform, which looked at basically trying to go after drugs that don't have competition and really demanding that they lower the cost of those, or the government would sort of get involved and kind of force their hand on pricing and their exclusivity rules, because, you know, historically medicines that don't have competition are the most expensive. You know, if you have an exclusive drug, part of, you know, the incentive system we have for pharmaceutical companies to develop drugs is to give them exclusivity, let them price it whichever way they want, essentially to pay back the investment they've made. And, you know, there's also a lot of conversations. I mean, that same bill would also cap Medicare, as Harris pointed out. But, you know, the same thing in the Senate, they went to approach this a different way. Chuck Grassley and Ron Wyden, that bipartisan duo, came together, and, you know, the centerpiece of their bill is a cap on out-of-pocket costs for seniors in Medicare. And part of it is also a rebate system for price increases. If you're going to increase the cost of your drug in, you know, for Medicare, you have to pay the government back if it increases over a certain amount. And a lot of that was sort of meant to get a handle on year after year price increases. And a lot of these different proposals that float around Congress sort of take a different way of getting at it and, you know, at this issue. And it sort of depends on where you're coming from, how it would affect you. I think there's been a real push and pull between lawmakers who want to take on a very broad, sweeping approach. Someone who says, look, we want to pass a really strong measure that could really solve the problem, you know, broadly, you know, for 90% of people who face, you know, issues. And then, but I think what's come through lately is smaller efforts, little ways that, you know, they're trying to reform the way drugs are approved or generics are approved, or, you know, ways to pay for or incentivize different systems of payment effectively to reduce these issues. And I think those are getting more traction as of late, or I think our discussions are having more traction because there's, you know, so much difficulty and so much fear of taking a big change to the pharmaceutical world. So that is to say, you know, going back to how Harris pointed out, there's different patients' faces in different ways. Cancer patients famously, maybe not famously, infamously, you know, face really high costs to get treated for cancer. It's a common ailment facing Americans. And a lot of people, you know, I tried to look this up, but I believe there was a Kaiser report that said something like 3 in 5 people who die of cancer die with debt because they've, you know, contracted cancer. And a lot of that comes from the treatments and the medicines. And, you know, there have been approaches to get at things like that. And, but, you know, I think this is going to be a push and pull for Congress in the next session, is to sort of ask whether or not they're going to take on a really broad, you know, approaches, like, you know, Medicare negotiation, or if they're going to keep sort of looking at small ways to, you know, tweak the system or address individual issues. And I think that's going to be a big, you know, theme for the next year or so is kind of, you know, moderate approaches versus really bold ones.
So broad approaches versus smaller, moderate ones is what you think will be kind of the sort of what we'll be seeing a lot of?
Yeah, I mean, I would say a good example of this is that, you know, things like the CREATES Act and a few others that looked at, you know, dealing with issues where people were blocking generic entry into the market or, you know, they passed a few along in the last year spending bill. They're very small tweaks. The Orange Book, the Purple Book Transparency Act, these were like very small changes to clarify the FDA's, you know, database for patents to make sure that people weren't just leaving old patents around or the database was kept up so that if you were a generic company and you wanted to kind of look to see, you know, what patent was sitting around and coming to expire, it would give you an easier chance of navigating that, you know, essentially navigating the FDA's approval process. And these were things that, I mean, there's a lot of agreement, just making small adjustments, looking down the road at ways to sort of encourage it. I think those are the kind of things that you're seeing come through Congress. Versus, you know, a Medicare negotiation bill, which is a big, you know, massive change to the way pharmaceuticals are paid for.
Right, exactly.
Can I weigh in on that? I think that there's a growing appetite, bipartisan, and I'm not saying it's going to pass, but you saw that with the Trump administration's pursuit of the International Pricing Index to link the prices that Medicare pays and perhaps even commercial payers pay for prescription drugs to much lower prices paid in other advanced countries in Europe and Canada, et cetera. You're seeing states pushing for regulating price increases. You saw a recent report from the Institute for Clinical Effectiveness and Research looking at the unsupported price hikes of 7 drugs, which increased U.S. drug spending by $1.2 billion a year. People are getting upset with these repeated increases on these drugs, which are already high cost over since they were introduced, multiple increases, sometimes more than one a year, to the point where some of these drugs have increased 300 to 500% since they were introduced over the last decade, with no notable improvements or expansion in indications or improvements in effectiveness or changes in the drug. So I just think there's less and less tolerance for these price increases, and I'm not sure that sort of modest tweaks are really going to address these price increases that are driving people bankrupt.
Please repeat that again. Another point I want to be able to sit with everybody.
I'm sorry.
This idea of there's less tolerance for these price increases that you made a really good point. Less tolerance for these price increases, and then your last point. Just wanting to reiterate that.
Less tolerance for these price increases that are, you know, literally driving people bankrupt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Just that point there. And then why do you think that if this is the case, there are no bigger solutions in play? Well, just if we could just address that really quick before moving on to Jen. Why are there no bigger solutions in play here?
Is that a question for Jen?
No, I wanted to see what you and Alex Harris thought before moving to Jen, because we're going to have her pick up on that too. But from the media standpoint, from covering it, why do you think there's no bigger solutions in play?
Well, I did talk to a drug policy guy at Vizient, which is a purchasing collaborative among large hospital systems. And he said they do have, you know, contracts in place that limit the price increase. Those are more for hospital-administered drugs. So, you know, the big purchasers on the institutional side do have some clout. But on the individual side, there's no similar group purchasing counterweights to keep down drug prices for, you know, pharmacy-bought drugs that are covered under the Medicare Part D or your insurance plan. So I don't know, but Alex might address some of the other business strategies, but I'm not saying anything that's on the scale to solve the problem on the horizon.
Yeah. Any thoughts, Alex, as to why there aren't bigger solutions in place?
Well, I think they're much harder to sell and to get everyone to sort of on board with. I think when you, you know, it's a lot, it's very, I mean, you know, it's Congress. Getting everyone to row in the same direction is very difficult. You know, you have to block off. I mean, if you look last year, the House Democrats, you know, they had the House. They didn't have the White House or the Senate. They wanted to put together a prescription drug pricing bill that they could pass in the House. You know, a bill they know would not pass in the Senate. They would not, you know, that they sort of came to realize was not going to be signed into law. And this was going to be, you know, basically the Democrats' messaging goal. It was the thing they could take home and say, look, if you gave us the reins of government, we would do this. And we would all get together. And it took months of negotiations and back and forth just to, I mean, to get one caucus that believe very, you know, that have a pretty uniform, you know, impression of this issue. You know, it's not that House Democrats are wildly over the map on, you know, Medicare negotiation or the way a drug pricing bill should behave. They're, you know, pretty in lockstep on this kind of thing. They had a big majority. And this took months of, you know, the House Speaker having, you know, three meetings a week with lawmakers, hashing out details, putting, you know, moving paper around, talking to various industry groups, you know, on a bill that would not become law. And now that they are in charge, that would look, you know, it's a big lift. You're talking about months of work, you know, really chopping up a big section of the congressional calendar to achieve something. And doing that is a bit, you really have to get everyone together. They have to make a very deliberate choice to waste political capital or to use political capital on an issue and, you know, run it down the line. They'd have to take a chunk of their congressional calendar for this kind of thing. And I think that it's difficult to do that when you have so much going on. You know, the priorities are, you know, innumerable at this point. They have so many different running priorities, I think, that they're trying to get done in a difficult manner, and I think that's going to just have to weigh on them versus, you know, you could take a few piecemeal bills and feel pretty good about it. I just think that part of it's political capital and the ability to push something through. That reality hits almost everything in Congress. So I do think they'll pick up this issue. It's just a question of, I think, what sort of battle they're willing to wage and what kind of agreement they can get on it.
Lisa, could I add another wrinkle in response to the issue of why there are better business solutions to this? One of the reasons is, and this it fits into the enormous complication of this whole drug sector, and that is prices are not transparent. Purchasers have a very hard time figuring out what the actual price that they and their members are paying, meaning employers, self-insured employers who pay for the health care of, I don't know, 150 million people, it's hard for them to figure out what the actual price of the drug is because of this very convoluted system of negotiation, secret negotiations between drug makers, pharmacy benefit managers, and insurers. So the Trump administration pushed through a surprise rule last November, which requires insurers to disclose, starting in 2022, what their negotiated rates are for drugs. And, of course, there's a lot of pushback from insurers and drug makers and pharmacy benefit managers to this new rule. which then employers, self-insured employers, are eager to see these prices. But without being able to see these prices, it's as with healthcare, the larger world of healthcare, prices
right.
are visible, and it's impossible to have a market, a functioning market that holds down prices when prices are invisible.
Got it. Thank you, Harris, and thank you, Alex. I know price transparency is always an issue. And now, last but not least, I'm going to turn it to my colleague, Jen Taylor. Jen, you want to wrap all this? We've had quite a robust discussion, and now we're leaning on you to kind of wrap it all up and tell us what is the legislative, what is this going to really mean legislatively?
No pressure. I'll just come up with exactly what's going to happen this year.
No, I
did want to say, you know, thank you to everyone for joining the call today, and particular thank you to both Maureen and Antoinette for sharing your story. They're so powerful and so helpful in trying to wrap people's heads around the scope of this problem. You know, I really agree with where Alex and Harris, have been landing this last half hour in terms of what is possible, what is likely. I think we really spoke to this tension between going big, doing something like this broad, you know, price negotiation, or reverting back to something more akin to what the Senate looked at last year with their Grassley-Wyden bill, which, you know, capping out-of-pocket costs and requiring some rebates. I think that's the central question, and I think there's a couple of factors that will dictate, you know, ultimately where Congress goes. You know, you would assume, based on very narrow margins in both the House and Senate, including, you know, the most narrow margin possible in the Senate for Democratic leadership, that they're going to have to go a bipartisan route if they want to be able to move anything forward. I agree with the sentiment that there's actually a lot of bipartisan support for prescription drug, you know, pricing reform in general. And as Cindy mentioned earlier, former President Trump verbalized a lot of support for this, though he ultimately didn't end up putting a lot of weight behind it. President Biden has come in with, you know, a plan for Medicare price negotiation and reimportation and linking price hikes to inflation. So certainly, you know, a lot of bipartisan potential. But I also think, you know, that has a lot of potential to unfortunately slip as we move forward in this Congress. And we've already seen, you know, Mr. Wyden, who was a big part of moving this forward in the Senate last year, has already verbally, you know, expressed frustration with the fact that they were able to get it out of the Finance Committee, but that McConnell didn't bring it to the floor and didn't really put his weight behind moving it forward. And instead, you know, he wants to find a way to get to Medicare price negotiation. We still have a powerful force in pharma who obviously has concerns about a variety of these proposals. And those of you who are covering on these issues, you know, back to the ACA, at the end of the day, you know, these same conversations came up around the ACA. This has been a problem for a really long time. And while changes were made, and we talked earlier about getting it part of the donut hole, you know, there were a lot of limits to that, because there are powerful forces that are concerned about making this kind of sweeping change. And so we're looking at these sort of two possible paths, one towards bipartisanship, building off of kind of what the Senate did last year, and this other tracking closer to sort of maybe where the House has been, where Mr. Wyden says he wants to go. And I think one thing that's going to really influence that is, you know, if they think they can get true bipartisan agreement in the Senate, you know, maybe they'll try to move legislation that way, but we're already seeing with the COVID relief package that quickly, you know, bipartisanship might give way to Democrats feeling like the only way they're going to pass some of these priorities is to use a mechanism like a budget reconciliation. And, you know, they might do that if they end up doing that on a COVID bill, maybe, you know, not too much around drug pricing goes in the first one, maybe something related to COVID, since obviously there are issues here, and recent reports showing that there's price increases in the middle of COVID might be motivational for some change. But if they're, you know, not able to get to bipartisan agreement and they're doing a second reconciliation bill, which they have the option to do this year, that second bill has to be paid for. And if they want to make lasting structural change, they've talked about it as, you know, more permanent recovery features, they might need something like an HR3 in order to come up with savings. You know, last year, the Congressional Budget Office said it would save about $456 billion over the 10-year window, and that might be really appealing. So I think there's all these dynamics, you know, from what people want to do to what they think is possible to where they actually just need a pay for to get some things done that are going to really influence where we land. But I think it's really important, regardless of what Congress is doing, you know, politically or procedurally, to keep sharing these stories, to keep making sure we're keeping this, you know, at front and center of people's minds. I think I was really moved today listening to both Maureen and Antoinette. We know that moves members of Congress. You know, this is something they can relate to. They may have experienced it themselves. They may have family members. They certainly have constituents who weigh in about these egregious and tragic stories. We saw this was last year. I think surprise medical billing was an issue that really struck a chord with people because it's so unfair, because it happens to people who, quote, you know, have done everything right. And so I think similarly, prescription drug prices can really tap into that same sentiment. And I think, you know, continuing to tell this story, continuing to cover it, talking about the fact that we are paying more than everybody else in the world and we're not getting better outcomes, there is something there that I think, you know, ultimately could move this forward, though it will be a long journey ahead.
Thank you very much, Jen. So regardless of what Congress is doing, keep sharing these stories. And we will do just that. We want to take some questions if we have any. Orlando, can you cue folks up to ask any questions they may have before we conclude?
Absolutely. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, press star 1 on your telephone keypad if you would like to ask a question. We'll pause for just a quick moment. And it looks like we have no questions in the queue at this time.
Okay, great. Well, if any folks, as I mentioned earlier, if you have any questions after you get off the call, feel free to email me. I can get them to our speakers. It's lholland@familiesusa.org. And just a reminder to, again, check out acttoendhighdrugprices.org. That's our project that we have with West Health. You can read all of our media fellow stories, including Harris, who was on the call, and Hazel Trice-Edney, who unfortunately could not join us. Thanks again for joining us today. Have a great afternoon, everyone. Goodbye.
And ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's call. We thank you for your participation, and you may now disconnect.